This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Joining me on Jodcast today, I have Stuart Lumsden from Leeds University. Hi, Stuart.
Hi.
Hello, welcome to Jodcast. Today you've been here to talk about the RED MSX source survey. Can you tell us a little bit more about that, please?
Okay, the RED MSX source survey is something we've been doing for about a decade now, in which we're looking for all the very young massive stars in our galaxy. So these are stars which basically are still in the process of forming. They're not the big sort of bright things you see in the sky. They're things which are heavily embedded in sort of molecular clouds in which they're formed. And we're trying to find all of these in the galaxy down to a certain mass. So these are things which are ranging from 10 times the mass of the Sun up to perhaps 100 times the mass of the Sun.
And what proportion of stars do these particular stars make up?
They're not very many, so we've in the end we've found perhaps 2,000 objects. This is out of a population of many billions of stars in the galaxy, so this is a relatively small sort of set of things we're looking at. But because they're massive, massive stars basically are much, much brighter than stars like our Sun, so you can see them much further away. So despite the fact there are not very many of them, they're actually quite easy to find.
And how do these massive stars differ from what we might call normal stars?
In several different ways. So massive stars, in terms of what we're looking for, are things that shake up the galaxy around them in lots of different ways. So they have really strong radiation fields. The nearest massive star to us, which people might be familiar with, can actually see themselves as Sirius, which is actually at the lower end of the scale of these things. It's a star which is bright and blue, really strong in the ultraviolet. All that ultraviolet light basically can disrupt the material around them, it can create big bubbles, and when they get to the end of their life, these stars turn to supernovae and go bang, and do the same again. They just deposit lots of metals in the galaxy. We're all made of bits of supernovae. All the iron in our bodies essentially is coming from these stars.
Cool.
And they also drop lots of energy, so they shake the galaxy up a lot. And we think that all galaxies essentially evolve due to the activity of either the massive stars they have, or a completely different area of research, the big black holes that sit at the centre of them.
And you're using the mid-infrared spectrum to find these objects. Why infrared?
Because these things are in their molecular clouds, they're actually hidden from optical light. You can't see them at all. The molecular gas essentially comes along with a lot of dust. Dust is like, in terms of opacity, clouds in our atmosphere. It has the same sort of property. Whereas when you look in the infrared, you can start to see through these things. The way this works for clouds in the atmosphere is exactly the same as for dust in space, that once the light basically gets its wavelength, gets bigger than the particles of dust, or the particles of the rain that form the clouds, it just appears transparent to it, so it goes straight through. So essentially we see these things in the sort of mid-infrared because the light comes straight out. In the optical, it just gets trapped by the dust and gets excites the dust heats up, and it's actually the dust that radiates in the mid-infrared. It's the dust, excited dust essentially that's causing the radiation.
Can the massive stars be mistaken for anything else?
Yes, their properties we see in the mid-infrared are actually not dissimilar from lots of other types of stars as well. So a star appears in the mid-infrared essentially because it's got dust around it, and that dust's re-radiating. You can have dust when stars are in sort of molecular clouds when they're young. And you can also have dust, if a star is getting old, it throws off some of its material, and that dust forms the material being thrown off the star. So these are the main sort of contaminants for things which are at the other end of their lives. The way in which we can tell these things apart is that the young ones, they're forming in molecular clouds. Molecular clouds should show up as molecular gas. Molecular gas, there's things like carbon monoxide, for example, and that gives off characteristic sort of radiation, which we can detect. So you look for this radiation. Also, massive stars, when they're forming, they like company. So they form with sort of other massive stars. You can see this really easily when you look at images, basically just tell that there's lots of things going on in the field. The more evolved stars tend to be more isolated. They've sort of wandered away from where they first formed. They're sitting there on their own, doing their own thing. They get to the end of their life at very different times compared to all things forming at the same time at the start, so that they're not all going to reach the same stage and get to the end of their life at the same time. So essentially you get this one infrared little source there sitting looking fairly isolated and lonely. And those are the evolved stars. So if it looks like it's got lots of noxious molecular gas, and it's sort of sitting inside a little group of other objects, it's probably young.
Cool. And what do the results tell you about massive star formation?
A variety of things. There's been a big issue as to how massive stars form for quite a long time now. We sort of understand how stars the size of our sun form. They basically form from gas just collapsing in on itself. That gas heats up just from the sort of like the gravity sort of pulling it together. Eventually it heats up enough, it starts to sort of burn hydrogen in its core, and it turns into a star. The problem with massive stars is that by the time they get to the stage where their core starts to burn the hydrogen, they also give off lots of radiation, and that radiation can drive away the material which is trying to fall into them. So they stop growing. So you end up with another solar mass star, where you don't end up with big stars again. And there are ways around this, theoretically, which involve forming stars through what are called accretion disks. And these are just things that look like discus around the star. It looks like sort of the rings of Saturn or something like that. And the material comes in through the disk and gets into the star's surface. So rather than just falling in from all angles, it comes in only along that midplane. And that helps because all the material that's falling in shields the material that's further out, so it's not being driven away by the radiation. All the radiation escapes in all the directions where the disk isn't, and essentially gives you a means of forming massive stars. However, there are various ways to get the stars to that stage, which are still sort of like disputed as to how this happens. And if we don't actually understand how these things form, then our understanding of why these things are going bang and turning into supernova and driving all the galaxy evolution is still very limited. Why, for example, do we only see stars which are perhaps 100 times the mass of the Sun? Why not 1,000 times the mass of the Sun? What stops it growing? This is sort of like the key to what we're actually after.
Does it tell us anything about galaxy evolution as well?
Yeah, because massive stars essentially are one half of what's driving galaxy evolution. Mm. As mentioned earlier, the other half are the sort of big black holes that can form in their centres.
Mm.
These two go along together in the sense that if you have lots of gas, you can form massive stars, but you can also fuel a big black hole.
Mm.
They probably evolve in a very similar fashion. What we don't fully understand yet is the exact linkages between these two. When you look out at sort of galaxies far away from us, in the very young universe, when things were much more active, you can see there's lots of star formation, you can see there's big black holes, but the exact sequencing of which came first, the black hole, the stars, what stops it happening, because the black hole seems to stop growing after a while, and galaxies stop forming stars, which one happens first, which one happens second, we don't really know. So understanding the whole process of massive star formation may actually give us a clue to how this whole thing should work.
When massive stars form, do they form in isolation with one massive star, for instance, in a cluster? Does that dominate it, or is there lots of big massive stars all forming together?
Short answer is we don't know, to be sure. It is true that if you have a cluster of stars and there's one which is more massive than the others, even by, say, a 50 solar mass star and a 40 solar mass star, most of the activity will be dominated by the 50 solar mass star because they behave in a fashion where what you see from them, their radiation and all the rest of it, doesn't go up linearly with mass. It's basically scaling as a strong power law of the mass. So essentially, the most massive one really, really is important, especially for a lot of the ways in which we see things. So if people are thinking about pictures of the Orion Nebula, for example, our nearest massive star formation region, in which you see all this sort of lovely red gas, which is ionized gas being excited by the stars, the biggest star basically dominates that process completely. It's the most important thing there. You can measure how many of the others there are there, but they're not nearly as important. So big things win out.
And how do feedback processes in these clusters work to regulate star formation?
Very good question. again, this is one which I would hope from our survey we'll get a better answer to, but at the moment we don't really know. There's another theory for how massive stars essentially form, which is that once the first ones form, you keep forming more because as these things are sort of evolving, they evacuate space around them, which means they're compressing gas, which is further away from them. And as that gas gets compressed, it turns into molecular clouds, which can then form new stars. So it's a possibility that massive stars, just by their very existence, form more massive stars. On the other hand, you have to have something which creates these stars in the first place. This is not a never-ending process. You can't go back to like the first star and say, well, what created that? Something must cause them to sort of form in the first place. And we don't know the difference between essentially this, what's called triggered star formation, where something else caused it to happen, and things where basically just a large cloud of gas has collapsed. These are still sort of live issues in terms of how all stars form, to be honest.
You mentioned there the formation of the first stars. And what we know from these are very, very massive originally. How does this relate to what you're picking up in the MXX survey?
We think the reason the first stars are so massive is because they have none of what astronomers call metals. And metals for astronomers is anything heavier than helium. So these stars are basically formed just of hydrogen and helium. That's important because most of the way in which stars are limited in their size nowadays is actually down to the metals they have in them, particularly iron. And what actually happens is the radiation pressure from within inside the star itself acts on the iron to drive off the outer layers. Massive stars are really unstable things. If you added up any more mass in there, it would just basically keep throwing it away. The ultimate example of this of a star in our galaxy, which the most massive star we know of in our galaxy, is Eta Carinae, which has possibly started as maybe as much as 150 solar masses, but it's lost at least half that mass over its current lifetime. It just throws off lots and lots of stuff all the time because it's very unstable. So we're looking for things which are probably less massive, rather more stable, much more like the mainstream of things that will go on to look like Orion, essentially.
And the formation of these stars, you showed a very interesting plot that showed they followed the lanes in the galaxy. Can they not? Is that because there's more gas and dust there from which they form?
The reason they sort of form the spiral arms in galaxies is perhaps down to the way in which the spiral arms themselves are set up. The spiral arms, in a sense, are sort of vaguely transient phenomenon, but what you get in galaxies is what are called spiral density waves. These are basically little gravitational perturbations that run around the galaxy all the time. So if you imagine essentially a whole bunch of gas, it's like a sort of shock wave coming through it, a wave crashing the beach or something like that. It's basically more energized when this wave passes through. And because there's more stuff in the spiral arms, basically it gets a bit extra lift. So perhaps it causes the micro clouds that are sitting in there, not doing very much, to actually collapse when this sort of wave passes through it. So you expect to get more stuff there just because there's more stuff in the first place at some level.
One of the interesting results as well you showed in your talk was that this, even though we have a smaller number of objects, we'll be able to trace a sequence of how the stars evolve and start forming. Can you elaborate a little bit more about these results, please?
I can try. There are various models for how these stars sort of evolve with time, which have been developed in recent years, which we think we can now actually show are correct. So the idea is that you actually start with something which looks very like how low-mass stars form. So you've got a little thing that's sitting there, contracting under gravity, heating up as it's going. However, the difference between the low-mass star and the high-mass star is that the amount of material that's falling onto it at any given time is just much, much larger. So you get about a thousandth of the mass of a sun per year basically falling onto one of these things. It may not sound like there's very much there, but that's actually an awful lot of mass. And what happens when this falls onto a star, essentially, is that the star itself becomes unstable. It can't support this. And what it tries to do to remove that problem is it just swells up. And if it swells up, it becomes cooler, because essentially there's a limited amount of radiation in there to try and support the size of the star. If it's bigger, it can't be as hot. It's got to be cooler. This has a characteristic sequence in the sense of stars like our Sun, which is only about 6,000 Kelvin or so, are able to support magnetic activity near the surfaces. These are what give you the sort of sunspots and the solar wind as well. It's possible these forming higher mass stars have similar sorts of activity, but rather than having sunspots, because they're much bigger, much more energetic, they can actually drive off large jets of material. And these jets are things potentially we can detect through looking for sort of what are called outflows. These are basically shock gas, which is sort of like streaming out in a fairly collimated fashion. You see these from some low-mass stars and the optical from the Hubble Space Telescope. You get these long jets that sort of extend over huge amounts of space. The same may be true for these high-mass stars during this brief time, because eventually the star is going to stop being huge and puffed up because the material that's falling onto it starts to tail off. So essentially they shrink then back to being more like a massive star. They'll become hot again. And once they become hot again, they switch from having these sort of like magnetic behaviours near the surfaces to being something where it's only the radiation that matters. The radiation pressure basically acts on the gas again and it goes back to being like a normal hot star.
You also showed that the rate that these stars actually gain mass and actually forming increases with time. Can you talk about that as well?
Okay, this is something which was one of the things we were trying to test, is the various models for how massive stars form predict essentially whether or not you form the bulk of the star first and then it sort of tails off with time, or you form a little thing first and then you sort of like increases with time. We think essentially can show that the only models that work are things which the amount of mass they're sort of like taking in at any given time is increasing as they evolve. This sort of makes sense from a sort of simplistic physics point of view. As the star is getting bigger, it's able gravitationally to pull in more and more stuff. So in one sense, it sort of sounds like it's a sort of really easy thing to do. But of course, as it's getting bigger and it's evolving, it's running out of stuff to pull in. So there's some kind of trade-off here. And what it's saying is something about essentially the efficiency with which stars form in any given clump. So if you've got a little clump of gas out of which the star's forming, we know generically for all star formation regions that about 10% of that gas ends up on any given star. We think for massive stars, perhaps what's happening is that process is actually slightly more efficient. It's basically sucking in more as it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. So that might be another difference between massive star formation and how stars like our sun form.
Brilliant.
Thank you. That's very interesting. Thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome.